Good morning, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm John Sloop, along with co-host Dean Welty. Regrettably, Rita Dunaway is under the weather, and Rita adds much-needed grace and class to the Crossroads team. So, Dean, we'll have to muddle along the best we can without Rita today. I'm really excited about today's program, Dean. Our very special guest is a former Massachusetts Yankee who had the good sense to move south, forsaking those liberal New England values to become one of us in the Valley of Virginia, a true constitutional conservative. Our guest is with us by phone from his congressional offices in the U.S. Capitol building, where he so faithfully represents the 6th District of Virginia. He also serves in the very important position as chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Of course, I'm speaking of Congressman Bob Goodlatte. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, John. It is great to be with you and Dean. I'm sorry that Rita is not well, but we wish her a speedy recovery, and it is great to be with you and your listeners.
Thanks, Bob. My very first question, Bob, is did you have anything to do with lifting the ban to allow the children of Washington, D.C., to slide down the snow-covered lawns of Capitol Hill?
Well, that is handled by the House Administration Committee, but I think it's a great thing, and I'm glad that children are able to enjoy that. It's a good ride.
There you go. Well, Bob, let's begin by getting to know a little bit about your background. You were apparently born in Massachusetts. What brought you to Virginia? And then just tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, and what led you into politics.
Sure. Well, I was very blessed to be admitted to Washington and Lee University School of Law. My wife-to-be, Mary Ellen, and I met at Bates College in Maine. And 42 years ago this year, we moved down to Virginia. We were married in Lee Chapel at Washington and Lee. I went to work during the summer painting school buses at the Bluebird Bus Company in Buena Vista. Mary Ellen worked in a bank, and she was admitted to the law school the subsequent year. And so we became the first married couple attending Washington and Lee Law School because she was in about the third class that admitted women. After graduating, I moved to Roanoke to work for former Congressman Caldwell Butler and then practiced law for many years before finally running for Congress in 1992. So we're blessed to live in this beautiful, beautiful part of Virginia, and I am honored to represent a district that runs from Roanoke and Lynchburg at the southern end all the way to Stroudsburg and Front Royal at the northern end, and of course includes most of the Shenandoah Valley.
Bob, thank you for that. I know I had the privilege of being given a guided tour of the Capitol building by you some years ago, and you very proudly pointed to this gigantic portrait in the Capitol to your relative, a distant great-grandfather, William Brewster. Tell me about that connection.
Yeah, so if you visit the Capitol, as I hope many of our listeners have, and if they haven't, I hope they come. My office will give them a tour as well. But in the rotunda of the Capitol, there are 8 giant murals about American history. And one of those shows the Pilgrims setting sail, not on the Mayflower, but the Speedwell. The Speedwell sprang a leak. They went back into port and all got on board the Mayflower and came to the U.S. But they're praying on the deck of the Speedwell. And the man holding the very large Bible in his arms is William Brewster. And William Brewster is my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. So that's my tie to that painting in the Capitol, and very proud of that.
Well, you have a great and godly heritage. He is holding the Geneva Bible, which I know you have a copy of, and was a great leader in the colonies.
I do indeed. Mine is not nearly as big as that one.
Good morning, Bob, and it's good to be with you. And we're going to be talking about heritage in just a minute, but I didn't know that about your heritage. That's rich. Bob, you already mentioned that you were elected to Congress in 1992. You're now in your 12th term. So let's just get started by reviewing that history a little bit. What would you consider to be your greatest achievement during that time, and then maybe even your greatest challenge?
Well, my greatest achievement, in my opinion, is my family. My wife, Mary Ellen, and I have been married over 41 years, 42 years later this year. And we have two wonderful children, Jen and Bobby. And they're both now young adults. Jen is married and lives in Northern Virginia and has a beautiful daughter, our first grandchild, Caroline, who I'm fortunate to get to see most weeks because they live close by to where I work in Washington. But looking at legislation, there are many, many areas that I have worked in. One of our most notable recent accomplishments was the passage of the USA Freedom Act. This is the bill to protect the freedom of U.S. citizens, including freedom from surveillance by their government. It bans this collection of metadata that you heard about for the last couple of years, where the government gathered everybody's phone numbers and calls they made and who they called and so on. And we passed a law that bans that, and not just collection of telephone metadata, but any kind of metadata, medical records, financial records, etc. And at the same time, we've strengthened the ability of our law enforcement and intelligence agencies to do the job they're supposed to do, which is to keep us safe from foreign terrorists. I've also championed the balanced budget amendment to the United States Constitution for many years. We brought it to a vote on the floor of the House in 2011, and we're working to do that again in this Congress. I've also had the honor of chairing the House Agriculture Committee, very, very important for the Shenandoah Valley, which is the largest agriculture-producing congressional district in Virginia. And now I chair, as John mentioned, the House Judiciary Committee, which deals with a whole host of different issues. Right now we're focused on things for, like criminal justice reform, making sure that our immigration laws are enforced and passing new immigration enforcement laws to be sure that we have an understanding that while we're a nation of immigrants, we're also a nation of laws. And respect for the rule of law is something that's been lost, in my opinion, during this presidency. And that leads to what I think is our greatest challenge, which is reining in the executive branch of our federal government.
Yes.
We could talk more about that.
Absolutely. Well, Bob, we're proud of you and your leadership. Of course, the Valley Family Forum, of which you are aware and have come to many of our events, is all about faith, family, freedom, religious liberty. And you have been a champion for those causes, and we're grateful for that.
And you have been so wonderful. The Valley Family Forum is such a blessing for the Shenandoah Valley and beyond. Dovetail very closely with the jurisdiction of the House Judiciary Committee, which deals with issues like protecting the sanctity of human life, like promoting strong families, and and in many respects, I think this may be the most important of all, and that is protecting our religious freedom and our religious heritage.
Well, Bob, in the last couple of decades since you've been in Washington, there have been so many changes in America. What do you see as the greatest concerns today for the state of our union, domestically and globally?
Well, I think it's the out-of-control federal government executive branch. It didn't start with our current president, Barack Obama. It has been growing in power for many years, and it's at the expense of the people, the state governments, and even the other branches of the federal government, particularly the Congress where I serve. About 4 years ago, President Obama came to Congress to give his annual State of the Union address. And like all presidents, he had a long list of things that he wanted the Congress to pass. Most of them were very liberal, some even socialistic in their nature, and the Republican-controlled Congress was not interested in his agenda, but we listened politely as we always do. But he did something different that I had never heard any president do before. At the end of his laundry list, he then said, "And if you don't do it, I will." And what really stunned me was that in response to that, many of the members of his own party stood up and and gave him a standing ovation, even though what he was saying to them was, I'm going to take your power given to you by Article 1 of the United States Constitution and use it myself if this Congress won't do these things that I think should be done. That is not what the Constitution provides for. It doesn't say, Article 1, the Congress of the United States shall be the sole legislative power. Oh, but by the way, if they don't use it, then in Article 2, the president doesn't say that at all. And that, I think, was extremely disturbing. And since then, we have seen time and time again the president attempt to exercise authority that's not granted to him in the Constitution. The states have pushed back. The Congress has pushed back. Lawsuits have been brought in the courts. Spending measures have attempted to control this. But it has been a very frustrating thing to have the leader of our country not respect the Constitution, not respect separation of powers, not respect the system of checks and balances, and to me, most importantly, not respect the people of this country who elected not just him president, but all of the other people in office at the federal level and at the state level.
Well, Bob, I've heard recently that even Jimmy Carter has said that there is no country in the world now that respects the United States as it has in the past. So globally, what do you see changing on the global scene and America's standing in the world?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that this president's foreign policy has not been guided by a principle that has guided many presidents in the past, which is peace through strength. President Ronald Reagan, and I think we need another leader like President Reagan, who commanded respect at home and abroad, and therefore was able to lead us through many, many international crises, but building respect for the United States at the same time he did. Much of that has been lost by a president who now draws lines in the sand and then watches as people cross those lines without the United States effectively countering them. We've lost respect in many parts of the world, and that enables countries like Iran, Russia, China to put their agenda forward and not fear any consequences for doing so.
Well, Bob, you've identified one of our concerns, and that is the growing disregard for our constitutional principles. And I recall watching you coordinate and lead a reading of the Constitution at the beginning of every new session of Congress. Why is that so important to you?
Well, it's very important to me. When we regain the majority, as many of your listeners know, I'm a Republican. Republicans were out of the majority from 2006 to 2010. When we regained the majority, there was a lot of interest, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion in that 2010 election about electing people who respected the United States Constitution. So I said to the leadership in the Congress, I said, we should focus more attention on the Constitution and make sure that people understand that when we write laws, they have to be founded upon that Constitution. And I suggested that we read the Constitution on the floor of the House with individual members reading small segments of it. We had well over 100 members on both sides of the aisle, by the way, come down and participate in reading it. And I asked my staff to check to see the last time that the United States Constitution had been read on the floor of the House of Representatives, and they came back and reported to me that it was 1800 and never. I was stunned to learn that the United States Constitution had never been read aloud on the floor of the House of Representatives until we did it in 2010. We then put it in the rules of the House. It had to be done at the beginning of every Congress, so we also done it in 2012 and 2014, and I hope that continues. It doesn't change debates about the meaning of the Constitution, but I think it does help to remind all the members that when they write legislation, it's got to be founded on that Constitution. In fact, we also added a rule that says that when you introduce a bill, you have to designate in the bill the basis, the section of the United States Constitution that justifies the Congress being able to pass a particular bill.
That's excellent. Excellent.
And it always impressed me, too, the particular passage from the Constitution that you read. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I read, at different years, I've read different sections.
Okay, the one I'm thinking of is the 10th Amendment.
One year I read the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which is the amendment that reserves the power not granted to the federal government to the states and to the people. And I don't think that section of the Constitution, added as a part of the Bill of Rights, the 10th Amendment, has been honored in the Congress, and particularly not in the executive branch of our government, for a long, long time. And there has been a growing effort to reassert that authority, reserving powers to the states that are not granted to the federal government. And I'm seeing that in many, many different ways. I'm seeing the states, for example, 26 state attorneys general bring a lawsuit against President Obama and his administration when after he said 22 times, he publicly said, I don't have the authority to grant administrative amnesty to people who are not lawfully present in the United States. And then he went ahead and did it anyway. So they brought a lawsuit. They've been successful at the district court level. They've been successful at the Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And now the United States Supreme Court is going to hear that case. And I am hopeful that they will also affirm the right of the states not to have the federal government dictate to them things that they don't have the authority to do.
Great. Well, Bob, we've been talking about the Constitution. I was just thinking this morning that we really have twin anchors for this ship of state that we've been talking about, the Constitution being one of them, but the other one being our Judeo-Christian values, the way that those seem to be in growing disregard and even contempt by many in the culture and including some in the government. Do you have any comments about that and how we can restore those core values and principles?
Oh, yes. Well, and first of all, I think rather than being twin anchors, one has supersedence over the other, because the government of the United States was created to protect the God-given rights of the people, and yes, that ranges from our First Amendment rights to religious freedom to free speech, our Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms and others. But our rights come from God, not the government. And I believe we must guard these God-given freedoms against infringement, whether that infringement is at the hands of other individuals or the government. So to me, phrases such as one nation under God and in God we trust are not just catchy slogans. They're indications of the extensive role that religious expression and religious freedom have played in the growth of our American nation. And this Constitution was beautifully and wisely written by our founding fathers to reflect those values. It does not have extensive discussion of religion in the Constitution, but there is no doubt for anyone who looks at how that document was created and who created it, that respect for the freedom of God-fearing people was the foundation of that Constitution.
Well, thank you for that, Bob. We certainly resonate with that answer. Speaking of the Constitution, how do we get back to implementing constitutional restraints on government? It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to try to implement it. The system of checks and balances, separation of powers. Now, this is an interest of Rita Dunaway's, and if she were here, she would ask this question. But talk to us about the Article 5 Convention of States to adopt amendments that are aimed at limiting the power of the federal government.
Well, absolutely. Certainly, the Founding Fathers knew when they wrote the Constitution that they did not want to have a runaway government. So they made provisions for amending the Constitution. It has been amended 27 times. They made it difficult to amend. It's not easy. You can't just win an election and a group of members of Congress come in and say, hey, we're going to change the Constitution because we think what they wrote back in 1787 is now out of date. It's difficult to do, but they set up two processes to do it. One is through an amendment offered in the House of Representatives, like my balanced budget amendment. It has to get a two-thirds vote in the House of Representatives, a two-thirds vote in the Senate. But even then, it still doesn't become an amendment to the Constitution, because then it is sent to the states, and three-quarters of the states have to vote to ratify that amendment. That's how the Constitution has been amended every time thus far. But because they recognize the importance of the states, and because as representatives of those states, they knew they were ceding some authority to the federal government, they also wanted to reserve a separate message to amend the Constitution that was reserved to the states. So there is a process under Article 5 of the Constitution that allows the states, upon application to the federal government by 34 of them, or two-thirds of the states, obviously it was a different number back then, but 34 of the 50 states that we have today, a constitutional convention can be called. Now, that also cannot by itself simply amend the Constitution, because if they come up with amendments, they have to send those to the states. Comes back around the same way the congressional-initiated amendment takes place, and that is to go back to the state legislatures, where three-quarters of them, or today 38 states, would have to ratify that amendment to the Constitution. That second process has never been tried since the Constitutional Convention that was held, which was a convention of the states in 1787, to write the Constitution we have today, which I think was very well written, very well thought out, still a very powerful document, but it has been eroded in different ways, and it does not encompass all the things that we need. For example, just a few years after it was adopted, Thomas Jefferson said he wished for but one amendment to the Constitution, and that is an amendment that would limit the ability of the federal government to borrow money. And that really is what is addressed by the balanced budget amendment that I have offered, and which in one Congress we came very close to passing through the Congress. We still have to go to the states for ratification. But
hey,
since 49 out of 50 states live with a balanced budget amendment, I'm sure they would have ratified it. There are many other issues as well that could be addressed in a constitutional convention. The balanced budget amendment is the one that's furthest along in the process now, because many, many states, now in the high 20s, close to 30, have passed resolutions calling for a constitutional convention to balance the budget. There is, as you know, another proposal to have a convention of the states take up any amendment to the Constitution. That has not come along as far, but given what's going on in Washington, D.C., these initiatives by the citizens and by the states to reclaim some of their power and to make changes to the Constitution where it has either not protected people's rights or has been misinterpreted by the Supreme Court and others is an appropriate way to address protecting the rights of the people.
Well, Bob, we're running out of time, but just for clarification, is that a yes that you do support the Convention of States?
Rita would want us to nail you down on that, Bob.
What it is a recognition that that process is a legitimate one, and I have been very involved in encouraging state legislatures to pass resolutions calling for a convention on a balanced budget amendment. Now, if that takes place, because it is so much further along, and is successful, then I think there will be a lot of interest, including interest on my part, in seeing a convention called to address other concerns as well. Not endorse any particular plan, but I endorse the process.
Okay, so that would include both fiscal restraint as well as the executive abuse that you've been talking about.
Absolutely. And there has been interest, as you know, in amendments to the Constitution dealing with parental rights, dealing with religious freedom. So it is a legitimate tool, and I think people are well within their rights to push for it. It also puts a lot of pressure on the Congress, because these amendments could also be adopted by that route. And if they are concerned about a convention of states, then they ought to get about the business of passing balanced budget amendments and other things that require these two-thirds majorities in the House and Senate, as otherwise they will have to see that power exercised properly under the Constitution by the people through Article 5 conventions.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you.
Well, I want to also just thank you for taking the initiative to pass the three pro-life bills of last year. And I think those included the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, and then, of course, defunding Planned Parenthood, which you've just done. So I want to thank you so much for doing that. You've talked already about the importance of fiscal restraint, and I know you're concerned about the national debt. But since we're running out of time, I wonder if you would say something, too, about religious liberty. What can Congress do to protect our religious freedoms?
You know, I think the United States Constitution, the very First Amendment, which was adopted as part of the Bill of Rights and was necessary to be adopted in order to effectuate that Constitution, because some states wouldn't pass it without those individual protections, did a beautiful job of saying the Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion. I think what they exactly meant there was they weren't going to have a Church of England in the United States. There were many states that either had adopted official state-recognized religions as the official religion of the state. We said, no, we're not going to have that in the United States. And the second clause, prohibiting the free exercise of religion. Now, unfortunately, starting a while back, 50 years or more ago, the Supreme Court and other courts have started using the first clause there, the Establishment Clause, to try to beat down the Free Exercise Clause. And that is not what our Founding Fathers intended. These were two provisions to make sure that religious freedom was protected from the government. And so we need to continue to work in that direction. There have been some recent court decisions that have been more helpful in this regard, but protecting religious freedom is vitally important.
Yeah, well, thank you. But I know John has one very important last question. You have 30 seconds to respond.
Bob, what qualities do you look for in our next president? You've called for someone like a Reagan, and are there any candidates that you see on the horizon who come close to having those qualities?
Well, I think there are a number of good candidates. I have not endorsed any yet. I would like to see the most conservative candidate who can be elected president of the United States to be the nominee of my party, the Republican Party. But I want that candidate to become a president who will be committed to respecting the United States Constitution, to respecting the separation of powers and the checks and balances, and not say, I've got a pen and a phone, and if you don't do it, I'm going to do it myself. The Constitution doesn't say that, and the president shouldn't act that way. So having a president who is committed to working with the Congress to enact the priorities of people, and someone who is committed to less government, not more big government, and someone who will take a strong stance to keep America safe and promote strong families and promote life are the candidate that I'd like to see elected president.
Well, thank you, Congressman Goodlatte, for a very informative program. You have been a stalwart supporter of the issues that brought the Valley Family Forum into being, the concerns for life, liberty, faith, and family. May God continue to bless you as you represent the 6th District and in your upcoming election. I hope we'll send you back to Congress. And our thanks to you, our faithful listeners. It is your generosity that keeps the message of faith, family, and freedom coming to the Valley. So please, listeners, send your contributions to Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia, 22803. Until next week, this is John Sloop and Dean Welty encouraging you to be salt and light and to make a difference for Christ at the crossroads where faith and culture meet.
Rejoice, 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 rej